from 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, it's The Bill. Conversations with entrepreneurs and innovators about their dreams, their triumphs, and their challenges.
Roadmap. It's the term developers use for the document that helps determine what new features will go into a piece of software. But it's also the perfect metaphor for the kind of tool that Earl Knight wants to build to help his customers navigate social media. This former professional basketball player has worked all over the world and learned that what we post online can have an even more meaningful impact in our local communities than on the global stage. And he's assembled a team to help businesses learn how to harness that knowledge to get more people through their doors. It's the story of Go Babble, coming up next on The Build.
The Build is made possible with support from 2820 Press, providing business consulting and content strategy services to customer-obsessed companies nationwide. More information at 2820press.com.
I'm Joe Taylor Jr. Welcome to The Build, joined in the studio today by the team from Go Babble here in Philadelphia.
Woo!
And I'll let each of you introduce yourselves to the audience.
Hey, everybody. I'm Earl Knight, the founder and CEO of Go Babble.
My name's E.M. Ricchini. I am formally the CMO, but I was telling Joe earlier that it's a startup, so we kind of all do a little bit of everything.
So
Earl often refers to himself as the janitor.
Yes, yes. I am definitely the guy with the mop and bucket.
Chief cook and bottle washer.
Oh my gosh, yeah. For sure.
And I think that's the thing. So tell me a little bit, Earl, about what attracted you to launching a startup in the first place.
Well, oh man. You're going to get me going deep here now. To be honest with you, I didn't want to be working for anybody else. That was number one. But I also, when I was young, you know, I really called myself an inventor. I would watch Frankenstein and want to, you know, shock little frogs with electricity. And I would design watches. Nobody knows this. But I claim to have designed the first iWatch.
Okay. Ahead of the curve?
Ahead of the curve here. At 7 years old, I sent my designs to Panasonic. And ever since then, I just love technology. I just love like putting my mind in things and challenges that most people aren't thinking that way. Just led me, and you know, working, I worked corporate. I led a couple of teams doing some marketing direction. And I just said, you know what? It's time for me to make my way into the startup land.
Great. And EM, you recruited from a more traditional path in broadcast media. Tell us a little bit about your journey into Go Babble.
So I am actually an art school dropout turned broadcast person. Earl had actually contacted me about Go Babble while I was still working in the news because it's a tool for journalists, can be. I loved it. I was looking for a change. Didn't want to work for the man. Just something about not being beholden to that kind of thing was really exciting to me. And I really think that working with Earl is inspiring because he is such an out-of-the-box thinker, and it's refreshing. It's a challenge, but it's a good challenge.
Great. Well, let's talk about the product, because this is a service that you've put together to help monitor social. Mm-hmm. And so obviously for journalists, that's important, but you're also reaching out to brands. Tell us a little bit about what Go Babble does and how you think you're solving challenges for your audience.
Wow, okay. Really cool. I get to partner my 30-second pitch, right? So Go Babble is a social media monitoring tool that really helps brands mitigate risk. And when I say that, I basically mean we do market research for brands, journalists, hotels, and leisure. We basically listen to what people want and tell our clients exactly what they want. We use location as a common denominator, and we use social media to really be that data source for market research. It's been really cool because what we're doing is so like next generation thinking. People are asking us, is there a way we can build smart cities, right? Like where there's an understanding of what's going on everywhere, and okay, we want to put a Starbucks on the corner because more people on that corner talk about coffee or talk about tea or talk about whatever it is, and they're over the age of this, we can gather all of that data. And it's so rich, so much rich data. It really allows companies to work agile and to know exactly what to do, when to do it, because the people are saying it.
So how do you actually go through and mine these fire hoses of data to get something meaningful? How do you eliminate the noise and the chatter that comes through all of these social media pipelines.
We're among the first generation of people that are kind of fluent in social media. Mm. So we kind of can understand how it's used and what people's behaviors are going to be just based on the fact that we use it all day and we can barely ever remember a time without it.
Yeah, we speak the social media language. That's so key because we are young. We're doing this now. And a lot of our competitors are older. They are reading a text, Instagram post, or you know something on Facebook. They may be reading it out of context. And so
they're like, what is that? I might have to look that up on Urban Dictionary.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But to answer your question, what we do is we take all of these APIs and we understand that, okay, there's a location tag or metadata within all of the posts, right? Within all of these records. Then what we do is we aggregate that content based on what's said in the context of the post, okay, what's in the text. Because we have an algorithm that actually understands the context of what's being said, it allows us to do really in-depth market research. When you're going to say, I'm going to go shoot at the court, it doesn't mean you're going to go shoot at a gun or shoot at the driving range. We understand that you're talking about going to shoot a basketball because of what you said previously and because of what is in your interest in your profile. We're one of the only tools to have this type of algorithm, and that's what makes us so different.
So tell me a little bit about some of the recommendations that you might make to a client based on what the algorithm teaches you about behavior among an audience group or a particular neighborhood.
I feel like sometimes the most valuable information that we can give clients is what they weren't looking for and that we might not have even been looking for, but it's patterns that you start to see, keywords that start popping up that you would never expect, but you see it and it's like, oh, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. EM hit it right on the nose. We always tell our clients is we want to find out what we don't know, right? And like through social media, that's the best way. Because like they don't know if one of our clients, they want to know when people are talking about it getting cold. And one of the reasons why is because they want to know when they should be turning on digital marketing or some type of PPC or oil.
Because okay. There's only so much information you can get from the weather models because it's not when is it actually going to get cold, but when are people perceiving this change to happen? And it's good for us that we live in an overshare culture because it's not, you don't have to look very far to find that information.
Well, I think that dovetails with something that I'm sure you've experienced in the transition from broadcast to digital. It used to be that if, let's use that example, if I am an energy company and I'm probably working on a traditional broadcast marketing pipeline and thinking in March about buying spots for October, November, December. But it sounds like because if I'm a marketer there, I could shift that ad spend to digital and get a much more precise target and say, don't spend in October, spend on November 15th. Or better yet, wait until our system tells you, go, hit the trigger. Mm-hmm. Like we've now hit the moment where you're going to get the peak response.
That's exactly right. And I'm so glad you keyed in on that. What the most important thing is for a marketer is not wasting money. You have to spend $200,000 to make $1 million. Okay, you understand that you're going to make $1 million. What if you could cut that $200,000 in half and still make $1 million? Then what you've done is you've mitigated risk. You've cut that X in half and you're still going to get Y and you save money. And that's the number one thing with marketers, not wasting valuable time, energy, and money. That's what we do. What is also really cool is we wrap it all up into a really simple platform and we're building every day. We've just added some new power tools, I'd like to call them, in our analytics suite. We're like developing new stuff just so that our clients can just jump in, see exactly the models that they're looking for. They can make real life decisions based on what we find.
Well, I think we're in Philadelphia right now, the home of John Wanamaker, who famously said, I know half of my ads are working. I just don't know which half.
Right.
We always use the analogy. It's like throwing spaghetti at the wall.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
And I think you're speaking to something that has been a toleration for folks in the advertising and marketing world for a long time. We have gradually moved away from folks with the golden gut instinct, right? My background in music and entertainment, and it used to be that you would have an A&R person that would pick who is going to get signed to the label. And now that job is a robot that scans Spotify. Because you could have someone that's maybe right 50% of the time, or you can have an algorithm that's right, you know, 89% of the time. What are you going to place your bet on? And it doesn't mean that there's not necessarily a job for a person. It means the job's different, right? Mm-hmm. So what do you hear from clients that are using the tool? What changes about how they prepare their campaigns or how they get their message out?
Well, what we've noticed is that they move faster.
Much faster
using us. Not only that, but they make confirmations. They set up hypotheses and then they make confirmations using our tool and just say, okay, and I don't necessarily want to talk about this, but actually, why not? We predicted Brexit, you know, and that was a really split. It was a very fast, like, okay, we know that if Great Britain leaves the EU, then we're going to see a down spiral in the NASDAQ. And of course, that happened when Great Britain left the EU, but who knew if they actually were going to leave?
But I think you bring up a challenge that's been persistent in market research for centuries. There is a huge gap between what people say they're going to do and what they actually do. So if you are actually measuring real-time data, now the bias is figuring out if there's, in your sample, somebody that's oversharing a particular feeling, a particular point of view. And the Brexit thing, I think, is an interesting example because all of the traditional pundits were really going on that gut instinct and saying, no, they're not really going to do that. They know what the consequences are. But it sounds like looking at the social media and hearing that drumbeat of, yeah, we're going to exit. This is a thing that's going to happen. And when it actually did, it sounds like you all were one of a handful of people who were not necessarily surprised by
that.
Well,
if you looked at the sentiment about Brexit worldwide, it was largely negative. So the rest of the world didn't think it was a good idea. But when you zeroed in on
it was the outskirts of Britain, especially
in London.
Yeah. Well, the rest of the world didn't get a say necessarily.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So
you think that it would be like, oh, the rest of the world thinks it's going to happen this way. The
American business owners were approaching that topic from the point of view of, I don't want to do all this paperwork. Don't do this, guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
So everybody was like, no, they're not leaving. That's too much. It's going to be too. But in reality, the people in London, actually, it wasn't even the people in London. It was the young people in London that didn't want to do it, but it was the older people outside of London and the suburbs really had a positive sentiment behind Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to leave.
They had a different kind of association with what that meant. But I think that brings up something else. I am in my mid-40s right now. I am officially too old for Snapchat, right? I'm not allowed on the platform, I think. But the feeling always has been that social media is something for very young people. So how do you adjust for any kind of bias in terms of, first of all, is that a myth? Are there many more people in older age brackets than we think? Or do you actually massage the algorithm to kind of even it out so you get a better sense of what's going on in different age groups?
I think you have to have different expectations with each platform. Instagram is mostly young folks, and Twitter is actually a pretty decent sample of everybody. You're not going to find like a 100-year-old person on Twitter, but you get a lot of different voices.
What EM is saying is we did a campaign for one of our clients. Literally, we saw that it was like 250 and over people on Twitter talking about some of the weirdest hashtags. But it was like,
especially that it's an election year.
Yes.
A lot of
older people are.
My parents are wild on Twitter.
Yes. Yeah. So they're hopping on. They want to know. They want to see. They hear about it constantly. They see it on their TV. Every single brand has their hashtag or their Twitter handle or Instagram handle. Mm-hmm. And now older people are getting cell phones and they're having their kids teach them or they're going to classes. I've actually seen on Craigslist, there's like services of people going to help learn social media and how to use hashtags.
I believe the free library is actually getting into that and doing more of that because it's in their interest. They feel like it's engaging citizenship, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that brings us to the idea that social social media as a multi-directional platform, are we not just sharing what we had for breakfast, but are we participating more fully as citizens if we're being open and transparent about what we're thinking about, what we're worried about, what our fears are? Coming back to the idea of Brexit, I think that opened up a lot of conversation in social media about the American campaign, because you had folks on one side of the spectrum saying, if Brexit could happen, if the Leave campaign could actually pull this off, what does that mean for the Republican campaign? And what do the Democrats have to do differently than what they might have had to do if they had a more traditional candidate go against? So I think you start to see the extrapolations, what we learn from that in a microcosm expands out. So what are you planning to do to kind of track, as we recording this at the end of the summer, what are you looking forward to in terms of tracking sentiment for various candidates or parties across the board?
I just want to tell you, we do have some serious plans. I can't tell you too much simply because, you know, there are some people that we're working with, but think about it like this. You know, if everybody's talking about Hillary or if everybody's talking about Donald Trump, we can absolutely track the sentiment in every single one of these states, find out exactly whether it's a negative or positive. Now, not everybody's going to be on Twitter. Not everybody's going to be on Instagram or Facebook and talking about these things. It just may not be the case, but we can do direct correlations with how the country feels and with how the polls are doing. We could make cross references and find out exactly who would be more likely to win.
That feels like a good thing, because I spent the summer of 1992 doing political polling research. Mm-hmm. It was hard enough for us to get people to answer the phone then. And so one of the things I think that's expressed on both sides of the political spectrum is how reliable are polls when you're relying on people that actually have the time and are daring enough to actually answer a phone that's marked unlisted when it comes to my caller ID.
Especially in a few months before an election. I think that's the beauty of social media, is because you're not going to them. It's like they're coming to you almost. There's no bias there. You're just getting tons of wild opinions, but you're getting people's honest opinions. Like in this case, I don't think it would be who's more liked. I think it'd be who's less unliked.
To be honest with you, Bernie Sanders actually has probably the most positive sentiment, but there's so little chatter about him as opposed to a Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. You have to throw that into the equation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what's amazing is that Donald Trump, he stays on the tip of people's tongues. And with social media, I mean, he's dragged it out of everybody, whether it's a positive sentiment or a negative sentiment. So you know one way or the other, somebody's going to go.
Yeah.
And so we're seeing that. And we're seeing that through social media. He's put together a wild social media campaign. And I don't want to talk too political here,
but I think it's an interesting use case for the technology that you're building out. Because it's absolutely the kind of thing where there's nothing more than politics do you get set into a certain belief. And I think more than ever before, we observe that our society has become somewhat polarized. Even on social media, if you have someone very much on the left end of the spectrum, probably a lot of the people they communicate with on social are also in that similar spectrum. Likewise, on the other side of the coin. And so everybody talks about, especially on Facebook, their one weird uncle or their one weird cousin. But I hear that from both sides. I'll hear that from the Republican family that cannot believe that little cousin Katie is going out on the road for Bernie.
Yeah.
Right? How did we raise this person? And then on the other end of the spectrum, I hear from like, oh, my uncle is going to vote for Trump. I cannot believe that. And everybody's kind of aghast, because it's the first time since we've had social media that you have such a jarring thing that someone in your circle may have such a different opinion than you do. Like, we're now kind of looking at how we've constructed these networks. And I often see that that's the big distinction between Facebook and Twitter. Facebook has evolved into something that feels much more obligatory. Like, you're on Facebook and so is all the people that you grew up with and so are all your family members. And Twitter tends to be more the people that you've chosen to listen to or who you want to interact with. So what I find compelling is that you've built a platform that's actually taking into account the quirks of each of those platforms. That's now, right. In terms of thinking far into the future, how do you plan to accommodate new platforms as they emerge? You know, if something really blew up, Twitter just celebrated 10th anniversary. Mm-hmm. Facebook's been around for about a decade, but I remember things like Orkut. I remember things that came and went. What's going to happen to Tumblr now that it's owned by Verizon? We don't know. So there's things are going to come, things are going to go. How do you actually keep on top of all the changes in that part of this industry?
It's an interesting challenge because, especially on the analytics side, I feel like everything is going so visual. Emojis, Snapchat, they have Instagram stories now, and it's a challenge because how are you going to analyze that? It's obviously much easier to look at some text than to try to figure out what someone's saying in a video. But like Earl said, we're agile and we're trying to figure out ways to accommodate it, especially since it seems like we're going back towards like hieroglyphics and all that as a society.
So it's an interesting question, but we have looked into the future, if you will, and we found some technology that can analyze video and visuals. What's really cool is that, you know, Philly has some really amazing startup, and I'll just say it, Curlate, they analyze visual. And so we could essentially use their API or ask them or whatever the case is and go from there. Right now, there's so many things to analyze, so many things. We won't be at a loss for tools, or if video becomes the wave of the future, or audio becomes the wave of the future, which it most likely will. I mean, it looks like it's turning that way. If that does become the case, we have those tools in place. And luckily, we've built an open source API. And I think that's what's so cool about us. And compared to our competitors, they're building blocks that you basically just, boom, put in, you know, it's so hard to integrate.
Well, let's talk about that. What it sounds like you're talking about is the challenge of enterprise sales, which is we have a secret recipe inside a black box and let our black box into your workflow, magic things happen.
Right.
And so what I'm hearing is you've built something that's very open and transparent, kind of in the spirit of social media. But what you're really proposing is for clients to plug their information flows into your systems. And the magic that happens is this much more targeted intelligence that's not matched by, you know, when I hear social media monitoring, I think of companies like Listen Logic, and I think of folks that are more often in the brand management and crisis management space. Like I work for instance, a hotel chain, and I want to find out if bed bugs have popped up. Like that's a very specific use case for that kind of listening tool. But it sounds like what you're building is much more predictive and much more casting a wider net than just looking for anytime someone's mentioning a brand.
That's exactly right. Because at the end of the day, we don't know what we don't know. And, you know, GoBabble wants to be there when those things that we want to know are coming up. So, you know, we have worked with hotels and we have worked with brands, and now it looks like we're even hopping into health space as well. But the reason why is because we're building an open source application, we can put in predictive models. We have data analysts and data scientists on board. This is what they love to do. It's a passion for them. So we build out those models. As soon as something comes up with anything in social media, we can drill down and really find out who is most likely to buy Slinkies in Philadelphia. It's weird to say, like, we can figure that out, but based on a string of text, and we see exactly what they said in the past, or what they said in their profile, we can come up with a general model that basically says, okay, these people are more likely to purchase Slinkies in Philadelphia. I know that's really, really weird. I don't like to say Slinkies.
But I mean, it's you can get very specific. So instead of just looking for the brand name, you could be searching profiles for, let's talk a little bit about what it takes to build something like this. So how many people do you have right now at GoBabble?
So right now we've got 7. But not fully 7. We've got 3 that are contracted. Mm-hmm. We've got 4 that are really home base. And we've got 2 more that are like part-time. We've got a bit of a team.
It's extraordinary that you've built this level of detail into a tool with just 7 bodies on board.
You know what, though? I'll tell you this. It has not been easy. And not only that, but you've got to think your way through everything. And because I'm such out-of-the-box thinker, and it's not just all on me, because it really is my team, they hone me in. I'm like a strobe light, trying to do everything. I'm messy. I'm like trying to clean every part of the room at the same time. And you can't do that, right? So what my team does, and what they've done in the past, and what my family does with me, is they hone me in. They reel me in. EM, she's so good at that. She's so calm and so poised. And I'm so like, hey, I'm coming in. I'm coming in late. Hey, you know, I'll be here. And then I'm just like all over the place. But, you know, she's like, okay, Earl. Or just yesterday. This is a simple thing. It's like, Earl, let's just focus on this one part. Because with me, you know, I'm a big vision thinker. So I'm thinking of every single part to encompass every part of the engine. Not just the engine, but how do the seats feel when the engine revs up? Certain people are just like, hey, Earl, let's just worry about this one piston.
I think it helps, too, that we all come from such different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And it really allows us to critically think through things with every perspective being looked at. Just troubleshooting. We always come up with really interesting ways to fix things just because when you have such a difference in opinions, when you get to like common ground, it's like, oh, that was really easy.
Right. It's the truth, though.
But I think that's the advantage of being able to form a team.
Right.
Because I know as well, like my team will usually pull me back to the center and save me from making goofy decisions that if I were a solo, I would be way off onto the cliff. Let me ask you this. What's the thing that surprised you most about growing the company? What's the thing that has challenged you the most as you've built this?
You know what? So many things. I'd say probably managing personalities is but I don't know if that's the most difficult. Finding money has also been difficult in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
We're not known as an investment hotbed.
No. It's
very true. And actually,
all that time.
Now, I say that, and
investment is spent on coily spring toys.
Yeah, there we go. But I say that, but there's been, for instance, on a couple of the startup bulletin boards and listservs in town, a pretty robust conversation because on one hand, you want to be very rah-rah about the place that you live.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, in objective terms, if you just do the math, Philadelphia does not get anywhere near as much angel or seed round investment as New York or Boston or Silicon Valley,
that's,
for sure.
That's right.
So you have to be much more judicious about who you pitch and what you ask for compared to, you know, Silicon Valley. You can be in line at the ice cream shop and just kind of walk out with a seed round.
And it's like that show. Yeah.
Typically.
Literally.
Yeah. I was expecting it to be a little more like that.
Yeah.
You know.
Typically, startups in Philadelphia that are funded don't even do that well. It's a shame to say it, but it's the truth. I think I know the topic that you're talking about. It's on PSL. And it's like, you know, one of the topic is Philadelphia a dead zone for entrepreneurs?
And half of the reaction was, gasp, how dare you? And it was like, no, wait, guys, this is math.
This is math.
Yeah.
But I'm also one of those entrepreneurs that are here in the city. And I can somewhat tell you, it's not a dead zone. Most of our business is international. We have a really good SEO guy, mm-hmm. Dr. Jacumba, and he's positioned us the right way on Google. So we get a lot of our attention through the internet.
And you've also got a kind of very startup-friendly tier. I noticed, for instance, that you've got a very $10.99 a month just to get started on the platform.
That's right. But that's a little
not to turn this into a commercial or anything. No.
To just get started on a platform, and I can, you know, kind of talk about pricing. I don't mind it. You know, we're like, hey, let's give everybody a free trial. We're open source anyway. Let's give everybody a free trial, 7 days. But then after that, let's just give them $10.99 for just this raw version of what's up there. It's only $10.99. But on the back end for our enterprise users, it balloons a little bit.
Yeah, but I think we've seen a very similar model work well for companies like Hootsuite.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
For companies like Buffer has something similar. So even within the social media space, there's kind of the $10 I can put on my company Amex card to get it in the door, and then I can go to my boss and say, look at this great tool that I'm using. Right. We should buy their enterprise level support.
And that's happened with us so many times. You know, we've had the likes of Live Nation reach out to us, you know, Dallas Mavericks, I mean, so on and so forth. It's just amazing to see that we have like two or three of their highest level, you know, directors, like event directors or social media directors, or just even like Dallas Mavericks staff.
Yeah.
Just some of the highest, you know, people on there. And how they found us was Google. They just Googled location-based social media and GoBabble Pop.
And again, the neat thing is that I often look at points of friction when I'm working with clients and where are the points of friction. If somebody sees the click here to talk to the enterprise sales rep button, that's usually ever voluntarily wants that unless they've been told, go get me this thing.
Yeah.
And so if you give people that way in, it's much more easy to get traction inside an organization. It can spread. I think the other thing that that I think Philadelphia teaches you as an entrepreneur is that it forces you to learn how to bootstrap. It forces mm-hmm. you to learn how to make revenue, which is something that when I talk to folks in Silicon Valley, they're often like, revenue, what's that? But we hear a lot lately, and this may be something we could investigate on the platform, mm-hmm. this fear coming from out west that the gravy train of these big seed rounds and Series A rounds is coming to a close, where VCs are actually starting to ask the question, how are you making money up front? They're not you're not waiting until Series D to turn a profit anymore.
Yeah. Well, you know, in Silicon Valley, there's so much resource behind these startups. You walk out your front door out of Stanford and you say, I'm going to start a startup for, you know, microphones, for people who just want microphones. And maybe the day after, you get a check in the mail for $2.5 million.
Yeah.
Right?
And then microphones, great idea. Yeah,
and it's from basically the security guard in the lot that heard you say that, yeah, because everybody seems to have it.
But everybody seems to have those resources. But then not only that, it's the traction mindset. As soon as a startup launches, they have a million users mm-hmm. on their platform. And you say, well, how is that? Are they paying for them? Well, no. What they're doing is they already know the guys at Hootsuite. Somebody's on the board of that other company, and they somehow transition those users over. So it's just like,
you just, a button appears in your dashboard that says, mm-hmm. click this to add to your toolkit.
That's right. Yep. And it's a community of people that are saying, okay, let the startup launch up. We don't have that in Philadelphia because everybody's so concerned about NDAs. Everybody's so concerned about getting the best talent, we can't even keep the best talent. And I talked about this in a PSL letter I just sent out this morning. It was all about the fact that we don't keep talent. We have the best talent. We teach the best talent. We have some of the best professors and some of the best higher education. I mean, UPenn, Drexel, LaSalle, Temple, Villanova, I mean, St. Joe's, Westchester. I went to Bloomsburg University. Go Huskies. And we're 2 hours outside the city, but I got a great education. You know, I'm doing amazing things. I feel like I'm a thought leader, but I'm here in the city. And to be honest with you, I feel like I'm almost being pushed out.
And everyone tries to say, like, not that there's anything wrong with this, but people keep saying, like, Philly, it's the next big tech market, yeah. Philly. But it's actually really discouraging to hear that and then to be experiencing a completely different thing.
Right. And I think that's the disconnect is there. And I've heard it framed a couple different ways. Why would we want to be the next anything? And why can't we build something that's here now? The analogy that I'm familiar with coming up in music and entertainment is very similar. I joke a lot that the conversations I hear among startups right now, exactly word for word, mirrors what I heard from bands in Philly in the 90s, which is crazy because just replace venture capital with record label. Why does nobody from Philly get signed? And everybody's kind of going to the same gigs and the same circles, but then the person that actually hops on the Amtrak and plays out in New York 2 nights a week gets signed immediately. And it's that thing, the best thing about Philly is the fact that people really do have each other's backs. But I think one of the vulnerabilities in Philly is that it can become so insular that it's very, very hard to feel like you're inside that circle.
That's right.
And then if you do get inside, there's nothing in there.
I feel like things are definitely changing. Like the Pope last year was like a big thing. Like we were on an international stage, and then the DNC being here, and then even big festivals like Made in America, people come to Philly to see that. And I feel like I don't know if we're actively trying to like change our reputation, because I think everyone from Philly secretly likes being like, you know, that Philly person that throws batteries at Santa.
The Philly shrug.
But like, there's this whole, I feel like we're on the cusp of something great, but we have to decide. It's our job as the entrepreneurs, if we want to stay in Philly or not.
I'm eagle, ride or die. You know what I mean? Like, so, I mean,
you can be an eagle fan on the West Coast. But
see, this is the thing: is that when you are an entrepreneur, the number one thing is take care of your company.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. And you have to make really huge sacrifices, and you have to be ready to make those big decisions and be ready for the consequences. Regardless, we've had opportunities to leave the city, and we were like, okay, let's not do it. Let's not do it yet, or let's not do it at all, right? I think we can build here, and I think that's what we're going to do.
I mean, it's a very affordable city to live in.
There's a lot of advantages.
Plus, you're so close to New York, so close to DC. You're kind of in the middle of it all, and it's it's a great place. I honestly don't know why this like boom in tech hasn't happened sooner.
I mean, so like 2820 Press. I love this. I love what you do, Joe, because you're shedding light on companies that need it. I'd like to say we're going to be one of the hottest startups within the next 2 to 3 years coming out of Philadelphia. And we're going to give back to Philadelphia. We're going to start more hackathons. We're going to shed light on 2820 Press. We're going to put this podcast on our website. And we're going to draw in a community of people, of open-minded thinkers who aren't thinking business, essentially, but thinking innovation, right? And thinking world of tomorrow-esque. Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something to the idea that you can be innovative and you can be scrappy. And there's something that happens in Philly when you combine those two. It's one thing to think of a great idea when you've got a big check from a VC firm behind you. It's another one when you're thinking about, I've got my seven people,
right,
and I've got runway, mm-hmm, and I've got a product. How do I change the world?
Mm-hmm. That's right. And which literally I wake up with that mindset. I was up at 3:30. I think I sent texts to these guys at 3:30 last night, and I was like, hey, so sorry about this late text, but just up thinking. Philly will draw that out of you.
Yeah.
That's what I don't want to go anywhere else because, you know, it's like, let's grind it out. You know, we're the Broad Street Bullies, you know what I mean? We were the home of Rocky. It's like,
and if everyone's talking about it being the next tech destination, like, why don't we actually do it?
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. And GoBabble could be at the helm of that.
Keep our eyes on you.
Yeah.
All right. GoBabble team, thanks so much for stopping by The Build.
Hey, thank you so much, you guys.
Thank you.
The Build is a production of 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Our producer is Lori Taylor. Our associate producer is Katie Cohen-Zonizer. Our talent coordinators are Katrina Smith and Gazem Yali. And our post-production team is led by Evan Wilder at Flowly Audio in Detroit. My name is Joe Taylor Jr. Thanks for listening to The Build.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Build. We hope you'll share this series with your friends and provide us with feedback on the iTunes Store. You can also subscribe to weekly updates and learn more about upcoming guests by visiting our show page at thebuild.biz. This has been a 2820 Radio production.